This is a download from the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, supported in part by the Daily Progress. For the latest on what's happening in Central Virginia, visit dailyprogress.com. Speaking of the Daily Progress, political reporter Bob Gibson addressed a crowd of Charlottesville Albemarle Democrats on July 15th. He spoke candidly about his long tenure at the paper and took questions from the audience about the state of the news business and politics in the summer of 2006.
Thank you very much for inviting me today. Can you hear me okay? I feel like I know most of you, and since I'm not a lecturer and am more interested in what you think than what I think, I hope we have a long question and answer period today. I've spent 32 years of my life covering news in Virginia and in Charlottesville and Albemarle County, and I must say it's a very interesting and very rewarding job. It offers a front row seat and a computer to sit down and tap out what some people nicely call the first rough draft of history. Then the politicians and the lawyers and the historians and the authors get involved and they change everything. History is constantly being rewritten, and it's being rewritten faster today than ever before. News and the news business has changed a great deal in that 32-year period. And so has politics, which is my favorite beat, even ahead of the 5 years that I spent covering cops and courts in Charlottesville, my second favorite beat. Dozens and dozens of trials and research over a couple of years into disparities in sentencing having to do with race. I think race is still the largest unspoken issue in our politics and our society today. It is something that when I was a college student, we were all very involved in civil rights issues. The nature of those has changed, and I hope we can get into a discussion about that today. Politicians have changed, and so have elections, and so have issues. Mitch Vanieres was one of the first political figures I got to know in this city, back when he was on the city council with Francis Fife and Charles Barber and Jill Reinhart and George Gillum. Mitch was the one who marveled at the time about how city council was spending money like drunken sailors. The first state senator I got to know well was J. Harry Michael, Jr., who went on to the federal bench. The delegates that I got to know well at first were Tom Mickey and Jim Murray. Have you noticed how everyone was a Democrat? Maybe Charlottesville is a little slow to change. It didn't seem too strange to me because I was from Arlington County, Virginia. Voting patterns in Arlington and in Charlottesville have been roughly similar over the past 30, 40 years. My love of politics goes back many years to when I was growing up in Arlington. I attended the inaugural of Governor Albertus S. Harrison, the inaugural of President John F. Kennedy the year before that, was a page in the U.S. House as a 17-year-old, and worked for a Democrat from Houston, Texas, named Bob Casey. No relation to the Caseys of Pennsylvania. My first political experience was in 1958, when my dad took me and my sister and our younger brother to a Virginia ABC board hearing in Richmond. We drove the 100 miles down to Richmond on a hot, sweltering July day and sat in the front row before three ABC commissioners who were hearing an ABC license application that was being opposed by my father, who was at that time in the PTA in our elementary school. The business proposed to put up an on and off sale ABC license less than a block from Stonewall Jackson Elementary School, which I had attended. The application was denied, and I always believed it was because there were three good props, ages 8, 6, and 4, sitting in the front row and staring hard at the commissioners. What I learned as a Capitol page in the House was that the government I'd learned about in textbooks was very different from the one that I'd witnessed in public. I got to know congressmen as human beings, very human beings, including some drunks, some policy wonks, and some who terrorized their staffs. One of my jobs was distributing letters from President Lyndon Johnson to members of the House Democratic Caucus. I'll never forget the reactions I used to get from those House members to another missive from, and then they'd use some rather derogatory term to describe their president of their party 16 blocks down the road. Civil rights was the major issue of my youth, that and the war and the war in Vietnam. As a reporter, I have rarely had and been an outspoken advocate for any public position in my job. I did that once, sort of went on a small crusade for a public defender office and was impressed with the Charlottesville Bar's switch to become strong advocates for that office. Mitch Vanieri's picked up the cause and for 5 years sponsored legislation to get a public defender's office for Charlottesville and Albemarle. 4 years in a row, George Allen vetoed that bill. The fifth year, we had a new governor, Jim Gilmore, who'd been a prosecutor in Henrico County. He saw the value of the office and signed the bill. Gilmore's back in the news this week. I'm sure you all have noticed. He's formed a new political action committee, and let it be known that he wants one more run for statewide office, either in 08 for governor again, or 09 for governor again, or 08 if there happens to be an open U.S. Senate seat. He's apparently decided that gentlemen named McDonald, Bowling, and Davis are not necessarily the strongest people to carry the Republican banner, and he thinks he can do a better job. He already has an issue. I've covered every race that George Allen has run, including his first bid for the House of Delegates in 1979, the one he lost, plus elections he won in 82, 83, 85, 87, 89, 91, 93, and 2000. Democrats seem to love to denigrate and underestimate George Allen, who seems to invite and thrive on those low expectations of his political abilities. The news business has changed more in the 32 years than has politics. We have a crisis in confidence in each business. Journalism outlets are falling into fewer and fewer hands of ownership, which is a very troubling trend for the quality and the quantity of the product. I don't know if any of you read Style Weekly in Richmond, but there's a very interesting article which is online and has circulated greatly in our newsroom. It describes some turmoil in the newsroom of our sister newspaper, the Richmond Times-Dispatch. The RTD has, according to the Style Weekly writer, who knows a number of reporters in Richmond quite well, been floating for quite a while with a little bit of dead wood on its staff. And they brought in a new guy from Newark, New Jersey, to shake things up. And he is accomplishing that. He's set up a system whereby every reporter is rated on a scale of 1 to 5. And the default rating is 2, and that's not on the good side of the scale. So reporters in Richmond are getting a little bit antsy after hearing that there will be a plan to downsize. Downsizing is not a very easy prospect to face. Reporters also don't enjoy much higher status in our country than congressmen or presidents. Each of us, I think, would do better with the public with more competition and with a code of ethics that put a higher premium on telling the truth all the time. Our basic job as reporters is telling the truth as best we can. Ethical lapses among reporters are big news, and I can't think of a better cure of lower journalistic ethics than self-policing and more competition. That's one of the reasons I welcome bloggers with open arms. Bloggers are poking holes in reporters' stories when they find them. This is a good thing. I trust bloggers to help us police our own profession. Our profession is plagued by fewer people reading and by smaller news holes in newspapers. Downsizing is not a pleasant process. What has happened in Richmond through a formal and very slow bureaucratic process, because one thing you learn about being owned by a giant corporation is that everything is slow and bureaucratic. The bean counters are the ones who run the world. Has happened in Charlottesville sort of by default. The Daily Progress has seen a staff. When I was city editor, we had 10 reporters. We still on paper have 10 reporters. You can't find them in the newsroom. That's because when someone resigns a position to go on to another job or to go back to graduate school, the paper is very slow in filling that position. So you're going to see beat after beat with fine young reporters who come here for a year, 2 years, In the case of Maria Sanminyatelli, 5 years. They go on to bigger and better things in journalism that pay better. And the Daily Progress, unfortunately, says, well, we have reporters who can cover 2 beats or 3 beats. And the position doesn't get filled for months. So that's sort of, that's the way bean counters also handle downsizing. I've learned that my daughter's generation does not always expect nonfiction writing to be truthful. They know what Google brings and that every buyer has to beware. And that is a safe motto for readers on the internet. Secrecy in government seems to be at a new high in Washington in recent years. And as someone who got into the business inspired by Watergate and how the press helped set that right, I'm troubled by big imperial governments that seem to have shredded oversight and accountability while intimidating whistleblowers and ordinary citizens seeking to set things right. I saw Al Gore's movie last night, An Inconvenient Truth, and encourage everyone in this room to see that film. Only an informed and active citizenry can correct the huge problems our broken political system has created and the problems it fails to recognize and fix. Virginia's political problems are not as huge as our world's or as Washington's. Balance, bipartisanship, and moderation are still seen as virtues in the state. Virginia's politics often play off of and sometimes run counter to national politics. This is a good trend. For instance, political scientists still debate whether it's coincidence or not that every 4 years since the late 1970s, Virginians elect a governor of the party opposite the president elected the year before. Democrat Mark Warner came in a year after Republican George Bush. The same for his successor. Republicans George Allen and Jim Gilmore came in a year after 2 elections won by Democrat Bill Clinton. Democrat Doug Wilder came in a year after Republican George Herbert Walker Bush. Democrat Jerry Belisle came in a year after Ronald Reagan's 2nd election. And Democrat Chuck Robb came in a year after Reagan's 1st. Republican John Dalton was elected governor a year after Democrat Jimmy Carter claimed the White House. It's an interesting trend. I like to think that Virginians are seeking a balance to counter the excesses of whatever is happening in Washington. We are close enough to notice those excesses that inevitably come when the national winner perceives a bigger mandate than he actually has and overreaches. Overreaching while underachieving is a political art form in Washington. Virginia is a state where Republicans hold a natural advantage. I would say it's about 52-48 in most statewide generic elections for statewide office, all other factors being equal. All other factors are never equal. Let's have some questions.
Well, that's not the newspapers. I noticed in Philadelphia that two papers, Inquirer and another there, that has been more or less controlled on a national level, have instituted a local ownership over against the national. You know, many papers have gone nationally. That is taken over by people in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, for that matter.
Unfortunately, that's a serious trend.
So do you see that? I guess that already applies to the Daily Progress, that it's a local paper as such.
We used to be a local paper. When I came to UVA, we were owned in Charlottesville. When I went to work for the Daily Progress, we were owned in Charlottesville by a family firm that owned papers throughout the western part of Virginia. All of those papers, or nearly all of them, have now been purchased by Media General, which is the Richmond Times-Dispatch parent newspaper owner, as well as, well, they've just in the last month acquired 4 new TV stations. That's where most of their revenue increase is coming from. It's on the media side as opposed to the newspaper side, which tends to be still profitable, but slower to please its investors.
And I guess my question is, do you see that not only will it be a trend, but will it be economically feasible in paper survive by sort of going back to the old way of doing things in that sense?
I think it can if people make the proper adjustments. Newspapers have a lot of adjustments to make. The internet is stealing revenue, and that's probably something that is going to increase. One of the major forms of revenue for newspapers is classified advertising, and that is flying out the door to internet outlets faster than people can count it. So newspapers are not the double-digit profit margin businesses that they once were. And part of the reason they were is because there was an economy set up where competition eventually got driven out. And the number of cities with large dailies in competition with each other is continuing to shrink. What we see instead is specialty papers. And we are very fortunate in Charlottesville, which is a reading community, to have the specialty and weekly papers that we do have. They're a very good thing, very healthy thing for our market. They're locally owned, and the competition is a very good thing for all of us, both in the advertising realm and in the news realm. I wish more people would get into the newspaper business, but it is a very capital-intensive business. There are better ways, perhaps, of reaching readers if you can do it through the Internet, which is why we're seeing a revolution in blogging and in other forms of Internet communication, which is how my kids get their news. You know, they don't sit down and read a newspaper today. They go to the computer, and a lot of us do that. So newspapers are changing. You're looking at a dinosaur.
It seems to me that there's a logic to merge the newspaper and the Internet business.
Yes.
It seems that you could generate your ad revenue on the Internet. You've got the news gathering. You've got the respectability and reliability. It just seems to me that should be something that should be strengthening newspapers, not weakening.
It is strengthening newspapers, and we're finding readers way outside of Charlottesville. One of the things I love about my business is that it's interactive and becoming much more interactive. Stories have places for people, and I know people in this room have written me immediately after reading a story. That's very helpful. It is the kind of thing that I think we're going to see more of as newspapers rely more on the Internet to get their product out. We have something that bloggers don't have, and that is a paid staff to go out and find and write news. It's maybe not as large a paid staff as it should be, but it's still a paid staff that does journalism according to, you know, some standards. Yeah.
How do I put this? The newspaper, when there's an election, the newspaper says, okay, here's the people, where's the person we think would be best for this office and so on, okay? And or something there. Where is that decision made anymore? Is that made in Charlottesville?
That's a good question. And I don't fully know the answer to it. I would say 9 times out of 10 the decision is made in Charlottesville. The other time I'm not sure. There is a wall, and I'm about the only person who goes through this wall, between the news side and the editorial side. I'm allowed to sit in on the editorial board, although I don't have a vote. So I sit there for the interviews as candidates come in. We had Tim Kaine on Monday, and he came in for an hour and met with the editorial board. It was a very productive meeting. There wasn't an editorial being considered at the time, but I'm sure the editorial writers will find editorial fodder from that meeting. There is at most papers an editorial board that includes the editor or editors of the editorial page and the publisher. The publisher has the majority votes in his pocket, and he doesn't say what influences that vote or those votes. I suspect in statewide elections he gets a little help from down the road. But I'm not made aware of that. We as reporters, and this is important, have journalistic independence from our editors and our publishers. The only time in 30 years, it'll be 30 years next month that I've been at the Daily Progress, the only time a publisher has ever told me to pull back was very early in my career when I was writing about race relations and Farmington Country Club. He was a member of Farmington, and, you know, it's interesting how Farmington integrated. You all know Durwood Chase. That's how Farmington integrated. He owned the newspaper, and I found myself writing fewer stories about race relations as it related to Farmington. And I felt terrible about that because I didn't think there should be any interference with our news product. Hank.
Bob, I'm a bit concerned. I'm a Democrat. I'm concerned for the Democrats. And I'll tell you why. I've been reading and listening, and I hear that all indications are, they say that this is the year for the Democrats to reclaim the Congress, state legislature, and all. This is the year for them to do that. But then I say, what are the Democrats doing to convince the people that they should be in those positions? And what I want to know is, what is the decision makers at the top of the Democratic Party? What are they saying? What are the plans? If you want me to vote for it, what is the plan? What are you going to do? What is your plan for Iraq, for instance, the war in Iraq? What's your economic plan? And all the rest of it. I think you need to spill it out so that people know where we stand.
That's a very good question, and one I can't answer, except to say that the leaders of the Democratic Party don't speak with one voice on any of those. We are now facing, we're into presidential politics for 08, because it isn't very often in our country that you have an open seat in the White House. And when you do, everybody in both parties in the Senate thinks that they could do the job better than the incumbent, and they might be right. So you see a lot of people running. Right now, if you look at the money, and that's where we look to find out how people are investing in these candidates, how they see their chances, Hillary Clinton, who voted for the war, is leading the pack by a huge money margin. She is probably encouraging all sorts of other Democrats to get into the race because she's going to stick in the 30s in approval and support in among those who vote in Democratic primaries and wants as many competitors for that those state primary victories as she can find. There aren't that many anti-war Democrats running for president. Or if they are, they're newly anti-war Democrats. There's one senator from Wisconsin who voted against the war.
I'm concerned about, because the Republicans are saying this about the Democrats. All right, now you want us, you want to get in the office, you want to take our job. Tell us what you're going to do. What can you do? And they hop on that because they don't think we have not done that.
Unfortunately, they know that Democrats are not in agreement on those issues, and they are going to say, we have experience in foreign policy, we have experience in national security, and the Democrats will say, look at that experience, it isn't very good. It's downright lousy. But what are they offering as an alternative? Well, you saw the six-point plan for the 06 elections that came out. The sixth point was to be determined. I mean, they couldn't even agree on six. So there is no national. I mean, you guys are Democrats. You're members of Will Rogers' party. There is no national consensus among top leaders of the party. That isn't the way the party functions. The party functions by putting forward candidates who compete with their ideas for nominations. And voters flock to those candidates who they think A, represent their ideas, and B, they think can win. And often A and B are in conflict. So, Hank, what you want is not what you're going to get. Because Democrats, even Republicans, they coalesce around candidacies. They don't coalesce around platforms.
Would you talk about the difference between reporters getting to the truth, getting it published, versus presentations that are balanced for just spin?
I think an excellent example of that was portrayed in the movie An Inconvenient Truth. Because what Al Gore did was he took a look at 600-some or actually the New York Times and others, took a look at 600-some papers written by scientists as to what was causing global warming and was it something that was man-made. And there was absolute uniformity and agreement that the CO2 we were putting into the air was causing this global warming. There's a scientific consensus of about 100-0. And yet what he found in the media, and this is very troubling to me because it reflects a flaw in our business, was that 53% of the articles examined by the New York Times last year, major stories about global warming, left some doubt as to whether it was man-made and caused by our own pollution. So we have to clean up our business by not creating an artificial he said, she said, that you give equal weight to just to pretend that you are being fair. If there is a scientific consensus, you should report the scientific consensus. I mean, truth is something that isn't necessarily in every case going to be fairly debated by 50% on this side and 50% on this side. I think a reporter has to weigh evidence and weigh consensus on things and report that. I see a real challenge for my profession to do a better job reporting about what's happening to science in Washington.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
Because this is not meant to be personal, but you know very well that you're very close to one of the problems there, and it's in fact Environment and Climate Department. So why doesn't the Daily Progress cover that? More than half of the Environment and Climate Department professors are pissed off about this thing, but nobody covers that. We lost a great environmental scientist because of this.
I know.
It's never been covered.
If I were on the UVA beat, and I may be tomorrow, that would be a story I would be very interested in getting to the bottom of, because there is a state climatologist whose writings seem to go counter to the scientific consensus. Although I have personally interviewed Mr. Michaels and had him acknowledge that, yes, we are responsible for global warming. That's not the message he is sending out when he is on his paid talks around the country and writing for various journals. So that's another excellent example of a story waiting to be written that has scientific weight of evidence on one side and sort of artificial political weight on the other side. I think, as a very close supporter of George Allen, may allow me to shoehorn this into the to Senate race coverage.
Earlier you mentioned that people should never underestimate George Allen's ability to win. Could you talk a little bit about, as a reporter, what you think his strengths and weaknesses are and what it would take to be him?
His strengths are that he understands politics and he understands what motivates people to get involved. And he throws red meat in copious quantities to people he knows very well in the base of his party. I think he is incredibly well-positioned to go after the nomination in 08 if he does well enough in 06. Because the senator from Arizona who leads the pack in his party has no one to his right where his party's base is better positioned to pursue delegates to the National Nominating Convention than George Allen. All of the Republicans who are seriously to McCain's right behind him in the race are not to his right. They may position themselves there, but George is there. And he knows how to appeal to the base of his party. He's done it time and time again. He's very facile. He's folksy. You know, it's a terrible word, but it sort of aptly describes him. Because if you've ever seen a shad planking, you know, you ought to go to the shad planking. The shad planking is an evolving Virginia political tradition. It's one in which thousands of Virginians from around the state, now political junkies, troop to Wakefield, Virginia, every April on the third Wednesday to hear a political speaker or two, and mostly to talk to candidates for future statewide office. Jim Webb was there. George Allen was there. George Allen always has a very warm welcome and a very close bond to people he sees at that event. It's real. It's palpable. You can see him. I follow him around and watch him talk to people, and they will test him on his being pure enough on certain issues. George Allen isn't pure on anything. He knows how to appeal to people. He knows how to go after his base and make them feel that he is going to take their concerns, their fears, their hopes with him. Well, his weaknesses are the same weaknesses that George W. Bush has.
Just imply that that
means. We only have another hour.
There are a few. I think he is excessively partisan at times. I think he does things for reasons that can be shown to be personally and partisanly related more than considering issues on their own merits at times. And I think those can be looked at by Democrats and discussed and should be. I mean, here's a guy who's a good partisan. Well, the Democrats should have a good partisan up against him, and they find that hard to do. The choice in the primary was fascinating because it was between a party regular loyalist and a former Republican. And the former Republican won. The only reason he won is because 11 or 12 current and former senators came in and said, "No, he's really one of us. You can trust him. He's really a Democrat. Don't believe all the stuff that's being thrown at him that he's still a Republican. He's one of us." And now those 12 senators and their political action committees and national party committees and had better find him some money if he's going to be in this race, because we're 4 months from a race that isn't yet a race, except in the polls. And the polls vary widely from, the June Zogby poll, which showed George at 48.8 and Jim at 43.3, to a USA survey showing an 18 or 19 point margin. This probably, I'm not sure everybody buys the Zogby closeness in this one. It isn't that close yet. They're just vulnerabilities. Yeah.
I'm puzzled about the model or logo that Webb has chosen, Born Fighting.
Have you read his book?
No.
I suggest people in this room read that book. My father sent me a copy after reading it and finding it a very valuable look at both history and a little insight into Jim Webb. He wrote it about the Scottish-Irish heritage of the settlers of the Valley of Virginia and Southwest, the rednecks in the world. And it is that group that he writes about as forebearers and argues passionately that they deserve to be as much at the table and as well represented in the Democratic Party as the constituent groups that have risen in the party. And he probably has a good point. If Democrats want to win elections, they can't do it on the narrow backs of constituent groups. They have to be a little more broad in there. But it is very troubling, the born fighting part of it, to people who in the Democratic Party are anti-war. Well, Jim Webb isn't anti-war. Jim Webb is, this is the wrong war. And maybe has a point.
Why should we trust Jim Webb? We have a congressman here
here within this district, who went from being a Democrat to being a Republican.
Anyone who's watched Virgil Goode over the last... He was a Democrat, but he was very independent, and he was very much aware of how his positions could match his constituency without matching his party. His biggest friend in the Virginia Senate was a fellow senator named Doug Wilder. And the two of them are, in essence, peas in a pod in that sense. They both found ways of representing constituencies without representing their party. And it was to their benefit, and they rode those waves very adroitly. They're both surfers.
I don't see much distinction between the candidates. And get back to Stillman's question here. Having been in the field constantly, talked to hundreds of people over the last 3 or 4 years, the same question I keep getting is, what do the Democrats stand for?
At which Democrat? There is no Democrats stand for. Democrats stand for whatever their candidates stand for if they support those candidates. There is no party platform. This is not Britain.
Okay. So that's the distinction we're making here, is a candidate-driven election.
Unfortunately, that's the way it's done.
People are looking for some kind of unified message, I think, from our leaders. That's the opinion I seem to be. Consensus, I get.
Yep. People in the party are frustrated that they can't seem to connect with their leaders at times.
And, you know, 70% or 60% of the American public says, we don't want this war in Iraq. Where are our Democratic leaders? Why are they not standing out?
Well, maybe some of them were suckered into voting for the war.
They were. Exactly.
Steve.
In the 5th District, we have the united message on the war. We have two people who are professional soldiers, and they know how bad war is, and they've opposed this war from the beginning. I can't see how here in the 5th District we can't get behind that combined message.
It made sense for Al Weed to endorse Jim Webb before the primary. A lot of people didn't quite understand it because it's not the norm. But the two of them do have a common background and understand each other and understand how they can help each other, I think.
Yeah, as an anti-war person, as a pacifist, it seems very strange to me that I'm enthusiastic about two professional soldiers. But I am, because unlike the leadership we have now, they know what war is like. And so they know they're against war. I'm not saying they're not religiously maybe against war like I am, but they're against war. And so they're far preferable to the people who we have now who don't know what war is.
That's an interesting dynamic yet to play out in the Alan Webb race, if there is enough money to play it out. And that is, Webb would be one of maybe two or three members of the Congress with a son, with combat boots, both on his father's feet and on the ground in Iraq. And when you're in that position, you understand where you don't want troops being and where you don't want them being for the wrong reasons.
I just wanted to point out that Jim Webb actually wrote an editorial or a commentary in the Washington Post before we went into Iraq opposing the war in Iraq.
Not on the grounds of a pacifist, but on the grounds of this is the wrong place to go to war and the wrong reason.
Many of the people who were Democrats were saying, oh, yeah, they were afraid not to support the war, but he came out against the war before we invaded. So.
Jim Webb offers the Democratic Party, back to your question, an opportunity that it hasn't had often enough, and that is to broaden its message and broaden its base. And I bet if you read his book and you sit down and you talk to Jim Webb, or you get an opportunity to talk to him at some point, you and he might find more common ground than you would suspect from the way that Born Fighting label rubs initially.
Well, I agree with you on that. But I guess I'm just thinking of this as when you're out going door to door, and you're met with these questions, or when you go to a rally and you see this hanging up in front, what, I mean, maybe everybody else understands the meaning.
No, I don't think everybody understands. Most people don't know Jim Webb, and George Allen will be quick to take advantage of that.
Isn't it up to the candidates to demonstrate leadership in their platforms, and that these questions kind of indicate at that point that at this point they're not doing a good job?
They meaning most candidates, I would agree with you. I think there's some candidates who do a very good job of it, and Democrats, I think, are naturally attracted to those candidates. Well, I mean, if you look at the field that's running for president, the senator from Wisconsin and the former governor of Virginia stand out as having different messages around which Democrats can rally.
I think this whole discussion about what's your plan, what's the Democratic plan, is a little bit of a red herring, but I think it's one that the Republican spin machine has put out there. And as I listen to this room and even to you, I feel like, you know, the press and even the Democrats to some extent have bought into it. Because, you know, look at the race when Bush 2 won in the first place. At that point, we had, you know, 8 years of a successful Democratic reign, and things were going very well. And no one was asking him what was his plan. He didn't have a plan. His plan was he was going to restore dignity to the White House. And that was it. That was the settlement. And it seems like maybe our response ought to be we're going to restore confidence to the White House.
Well, Mark Warner is running on that message. I mean, Mark Warner is taking that message to Iowa and to New Hampshire and saying, we don't have to be a narrow constituency-based party. We can run on sound competence that has shown an ability to govern from the middle and to appeal to different groups than Democrats are traditionally appealing to. And that's exactly his message.
But if you look at the message that's coming from the press, it's very much sticking to the Republican talking points, which is, the Democrats are all over the map. They don't know what they stand for. I'm not sure that that's true, or I certainly don't think it's any more true.
I'm not sure it's a bad thing that Democrats offer a choice of messages around which to rally.
I think it's seeped into the public consciousness that's a liability for us. And rather, you know, I haven't read any press editorial or anything saying, look, just as George Bush promised dignity, whatever that means, or compassionate conservatives,
whatever that means,
the Democratic Party is offering confidence. I've seen a lot of criticism about how disparate the Democratic field is. And I think that's seeped into the popular consciousness to the point where we now have to go out and address it.
Well, I agree with you, and I can't make a message for the Democratic Party because, A, I don't have standing to, and B, they wouldn't buy it if I tried.
But is it a message for the party, or is it what the press chooses to amplify? Yeah.
The press chooses to amplify those candidates who seem to be gravitating, having support gravitate to them based on whatever reason. And I think it has to do with contrast to what's happening in Washington. And right now, the coverage of the Democratic Party field is, I think, quite fairly Hillary versus the rest of the field. And it remains to be seen who is going to stand out in the rest of the field, if anyone, and become a more electable choice. And that's a decision that groups like this are going to be making all over the country for the next year or two. I can't blast the press for the way it's being covered because I don't think there is a consensus. Lloyd.
In 1932, Will Rogers commented about the repression.
presidential campaign that I talked about the depression. He said, "Liar, the Republican message is this. Liars and fools got us into it, and liars and fools are going to get us out of it." And it seems to me that that is basically the point that Democrats have to make, that that's the Republican message. Liars and fools got us into this war. Liars and fools are going to get us out of it. If you believe that, vote Republican. If you don't, vote Democratic. And that we make a profound mistake if we try to insist that there is one Democratic answer right now. Because one thing I've learned as a trial lawyer is if a defense lawyer puts out a proposal, a proposed theory of how the crime was committed by somebody other than your client, you better be able to prove that. Because that then becomes the focus of the debate. But the focus of the debate in a criminal case is never about whether the defendant can prove somebody else did it. It's whether the government can prove that your guy did it. The focus of the debate in this case in 2006 can't be whether Jim Webb has a better plan to get out. It has to be, do you trust the jerks who got us in to get us out? And if the answer to that is no, I don't trust the guys who got us in there to get us out again, then there's only one answer, and that is we need a change. That's the first point I wanted. The second point I wanted to make is that I think the Democrats as a whole, drawing on another point I guess he was making, not only can we say, well, gee, the press has bought this idea that Democrats have to have a unified message, and their failure to have a unified message or a unified answer to, I mean, it was Kevin, I don't know whoever it was saying that the Democrats have failed to produce this unified message. We Democrats have bought the notion that that's the valid text. We sit here and navel gaze over whether we have the right answer or whether one person's answer of saying, I want to set a goal of getting out in by the end of the year versus in 12 months versus 18 months. Is that what this debate is about?
I think trust is the key word that you just said. And would I trust a party that had talking points that everybody hewed to and bought as their talking points and that they came out of some factory in Washington? Or would I trust a party that thought for itself and had different ideas and valid criticisms? I'd trust the latter, I think, before I trust the former. But what I'm seeing more is the former. So, you know, I think you're in better shape not having the manufactured position. You're in better shape having the honest debate.
But Democrats, it seems to me, have bought the notion that, oh, gee, they're right. This is awful. We don't have a unified message. My goodness, it's our fault.
Wait,
it's not.
May I add to that, please? There is a very simple issue here that we can all be unified on and we all have a consensus on that we need to get out of Iraq. Would you agree to that?
Absolutely.
Okay, there's one for you. Here's another one. The budget deficit. There's two for you. I think we can all agree on these specific items, these major issues. And
well, then why can't the party come up with six of them?
Well, that would be even better.
Ask gas to it. Gas prices.
Gas prices will be on the list.
You know, simple issues that are very important to people and reach a consensus on that.
But then we end up fighting about whether getting out of Iraq means in 12 months or 18 months. It means about whether getting out of Iraq means a definite timetable versus a long-term goal. And that, like I said, that's just talking about red herring. That's the wrong debate for us, at least, to be having.
And not with my children and others who are involved in these wars that we don't want.
Yes.
Two questions. So one is, we're talking about getting out of Iraq, but we're building the largest embassy in the world in Iraq, and we're building permanent air bases in Iraq. What does that mean about getting out of Iraq?
That's a major difference, and I hope a major issue between George Allen and Jim Webb this year.
Jim Webb, if you watched ABC's Sunday morning program last Sunday with Stephanopoulos, made a point of saying the real difference between us is I want us to say we are not going to have a permanent presence in Iraq. And George Allen was able to criticize Webb for, you know, not backing Kerry and, you know, not having a specific timetable and yet being for getting out. But he did not take the position that the United States needs to tell the Iraqis we have no permanent design on permanent bases in your country. That should be a major issue. And next Saturday at the Homestead in Bath County, right down the street from Creedede's law office, when Jim Webb and George Allen hold their first debate before the Virginia Bar Association, I hope that will be one of the things that is clearly delineated and discussed. Yeah, and another question.
My second question is going back to what you asked us to talk about in the first place, and that is the racial situation. The Tribune, Agnes Contract, came out with the fact that the immigration amnesty issue was devastating to the African Americans because it was holding down the minimum wage. It was taking jobs, from illegal immigrants, taking jobs, taking services, and holding down the minimum wage by taking low pay. She thought that that was a very critical issue. What do you think of that?
I think the minimum wage has to be one of the talking points that Democrats talk about a great deal, and can bring Hispanic Democrats and Black Democrats to a more interesting and participatory part of this debate, because illegal immigration is going to be an issue that's exploited for years. Republicans are showing that they can't even agree between their own House and their own Senate on how to handle it because it's so explosive. And because the labels that are thrown on people are so incendiary, Democrats have a real opportunity to stand up for civil rights on this. They haven't yet done it, but they have that opportunity. Yes?
We have gone through a series of campaigns where there have been things called wedge issues.
Yeah.
And I really think that we have been, we've kind of bought into an oversimplified model that says, you know, this wedge issue or no car tax or whatever it might be is a valid political point. And obviously it has been for people that voted that way.
It's a valid political point. It's not a valid governing point.
Yeah, but it strikes me that we've got plenty of wedge issues that are more fundamentally and deeper based than the ones that have been talked about, and somehow or the other we have failed to articulate them.
Yeah.
That is, Don Beyer could have been elected governor, but he couldn't figure out the car tax.
He came out at the same debate, the one that I'm going to on Saturday, in his first debate with Jim Gilmore. He came out with something called Car Tax Light, and he tried to sell that, and it didn't sell. It was one of the biggest mistakes that that campaign made. And Gilmore wrote a phony issue, at least when it comes to governing. It wasn't a phony issue when it comes to getting votes.
But we got, you know, this whole issue of competence, of knee-jerk decision making that has been resulting in poor policy, poor decisions, poor results. Those are wedge issues. And we ought to be able to figure out a way to make those wedge issues that, you know, when I came up in politics early, the question was, Roosevelt saved the country farm. And I ain't going to vote for any damn Republican because Roosevelt stopped the banks from taking my farm. That was a wedge issue. We didn't call it a wedge issue then, but there are a whole bunch of them out there, civil rights, whatever, And now we've got a wedge issue called the marriage amendment. And we bought into that being, you know, a reason for voting one or another. And it's truly counterproductive.
It's worse than counterproductive. Yes.
Thinking about George Allen, it seems to me that our president is at a fairly low ebb. And I'm not sure whether he's going to recover by election time or not. One of the things that is said is that the economy is the thing that most people pay attention to.
Right.
With regard to how is the economy being handled? Well, he made great progress. I mean, made a great comment about the fact that the deficit was going down. So it's, I guess it's $275 trillion now. It seems to me that the fact that George Allen has voted for Mr. Bush's program, whatever it is, 97% of the time.
Variously, 94 to 97 on various measures.
Whatever it is, I would certainly hop on that because of Bush's lack of popularity at the moment and the fact that every time he turns around, he makes a terrible mistake. And the public is finally becoming aware of this. I don't know why it takes so long.
Let's see, you raise an interesting point. Is this going to be a federal election in Virginia this year, or is this going to be a state election? George Allen is probably going to want to run as a former governor.
Well, let him run as a former governor, but let's run against him as an ally to a president that is worldwide is favored, and it is becoming more and more evident. Look at us in Afghanistan. The Russians went into Afghanistan, and it was a terrible disaster for Russia. And they finally had enough sense to get out. I don't know how many years, 7, 8 years, whatever.
Yeah.
And so what do? We go in?
Well, you make a good point that it has to be a federal election. But, you know, oil is at 77.04 or something like that, a barrel. The tank that Webb is sitting on has $450,000 in it. The tank that George is sitting on has $6.6 million in it. And it's... The Democratic Party of Virginia can't rely on the Chuck Schumers of the world to win this election. I mean, he did everything he could to get the nominee that the party in Washington wanted, but it's the party in Virginia that's probably going to win or lose the election.
I would just like to note that it wasn't only that George Bush was elected in 2000. It was that George Allen was elected in 2000. There are three triggers to our present disaster. One, election of Bush. Two, election of Allen. Three, food becoming a Republican. And if you want to look at some ironies of the situation, every budget that Good, when Good was a Democrat, the budget was in balance. Only when we put him in charge of spending by putting him on the Appropriations Committee did things go to hell.
Yes.
Getting back to the press, my impression often, particularly when you're looking at talking heads exchanging points of view, that a lot of the focus is on the gamesmanship and the political horse race rather than on governance and real effects.
That's true.
And that, you know, who's going to win, who's going to get ahead, what's the next poll going to say?
Yeah. Oh, horse race coverage of an election really does distort the nature of the election.
It's actually, you know, pressing people on the issue of the effect of the legislation, the effect of the executive decision, and pushing on the governance side is very important for the press.
You're exactly right, and that's one difference between newspapers, which have a little more ink to throw at these things, and other media, which tend to more heavily cover the horse race aspects and the sort of the political jockeying aspects of the contest. There is much more at stake than the superficial and the numbers. And it's our job to discuss those things as well as what people want to know, which is, you know, does this guy have a chance? who's supporting him, how much support does he have. I mean, people do want to know that, but that's not crucial to people's making up their minds. What is an understanding of the differences that the candidates bring to the table. Yeah.
Kind of curious, getting your head a little bit. As a reporter that said you have reasonable independence, how do you decide what you want to cover and what you don't want to cover? Use Butte and MZM as an example. I mean, in California, you know, the whole Cunningham Way thing was very well covered. In Florida, it was as well. Here, clearly, you know, you earmark stuff for Inzik and you earmark stuff for the Southwest. He took $100,000 and then he said, well, he didn't really know where it came from. And everybody seems to believe that, and the press seems to have just left it alone. How did those decisions get made?
Good question. We look at what we see in front of us and we question it. I think Virgil Good has laid out a position that he didn't know the funds to him were bundled, that he didn't know they were illegal campaign contributions, that he didn't know that Mitchell Wade was responsible for passing the money that was passed to him, and that he didn't act for MZM based on any of that, but rather on what was economically good for the 5th District. We have to lay those facts out, and we have to look at them, and we have to question them, and we have to go to people inside and say, you know, is this what really happened? That is going on. It's been going on at our newspaper. It's been going on at the Roanoke Times, which covers our district rather well. All I can say is that we're looking at that, and that the MZM story is not over. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good reporting. A lot of it's on the internet on this. If you Google MZM Wade and Good, you're going to find a lot to read. And before this election, you'll probably find a lot more to read. And I hope people will be more familiar with the issues and what exactly happened.
Bob,
yeah.
Related question to that: do you think your coverage has of the Inzik aspects of the MZM scandal has been sufficient?
No. I've spent a lot of time talking to whistleblowers and others at the National Ground Intelligence Center, and I hope to do a lot more reporting on that.
Right. A major part of the MZM scandal is right here in Albemarle County.
How we got into war has something to do with what was cooked up right here. That is the standard fare of all coverage, and we're not going to ignore it. But hopefully, we're going to go beyond it. Yeah, people want to know who has a chance. People want to know who is supporting or not supporting someone. Those are factors that go into people's decisions as they decide, you know, whether to throw themselves into a campaign or who to support. But they aren't the major. Yeah. No. No. I think people want to find out the issue differences between the candidates.
A lot of times, candidates obfuscate the issue.
Of course, they intentionally do that. They don't want to be as clear on that as they could be. Yes, David.
We spend a lot of time on national issues, but most of the time, this focuses on state issues. It seems to me.
Yes. I think Governor Kaine's first 6 months in office, which just are concluding, are roughly comparable to Governor Warner's first 6 months in office. He was treated about this. Mark Warner was treated about the same way as Tim Kaine was. If something came through the House of Delegates with his name on it, it was in jeopardy. And the House Republicans are very sensitive right now, having lost 2 years ago on a major vote, and that catapulted Warner into successful conclusion of a budget impasse, and helped make his reputation for the last 2 years of his, not to be as accommodating to the current governor, and they've been very successful at that, to the point of even knocking down the last $22 million of budget amendments just the end of last month. I asked Kaine about that on Monday, and he said, yeah, he thought he was treated about the same way Warner was, and hopes to have about the same trajectory.
We got one more here.
Yes.
My question is, what is a gallon of gas going to cost a few months before the 2008 presidential election, Don? And if it's going to be much higher than it is today, and I predict it will be, my question is, does any political party have any responsibility in this? And if we think that it's the Republicans' party that has been supporting oil subsidies and oil profits, can't we label this as a Republican Party problem?
Can the Democrats point to a significant policy difference?
Well, they should be able to. Actually, that's my question. You know,
you're right.
Why aren't we maximizing this problem?
I don't have the answer to that. I expect oil to be, gas to be $4 a gallon any day now, given what's going on in the Middle East. And, policies are driving that, and policies supporting the oil companies the Democrats have not come up with their own alternative that has been put successfully forward. I mean, it's incumbent on the party out of power to come up with positions that people will find responsible, compared to those that are politically, economically, and through campaign contribution, largesse, the ones that have been successful for the last.
And, of course, the people who are driving the SUVs have to change their way of thinking. That's not going to be easy.
Well, I think we'll see that. I think we're going to see American consumers become a lot savvier and a lot more demanding in the next year or two. It's an inevitable result of what we're going to face. And we're not that dumb, I hope. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to Bob Gibson of the Daily Progress on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. To find out more, visit SeavillePodcast.com. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening.